Rescuing a Rescue Mission. What happens when things go wrong in space? You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. A mission to save a falling spacecraft is now in need of its own rescue. Catalyst Space's Link satellite launched to raise the Swift Observatory's altitude. But before it could do that, it ran into some trouble of its own.
They lost two of the three reaction wheels. These are momentum wheels that spins very rapidly inside the spacecraft to control the pointing of the spacecraft.
We'll speak with Ars Technica's Stephen Clark about the latest on the efforts to rescue the rescue mission. Then, when problems occur with satellites and spacecraft, how do engineers fix them?
You got to look at all of the kind of the typical things that could go wrong and kind of go down a list of troubleshooting steps.
We'll speak with Florida Tech's Don Platt about how teams deal with problems in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For over two decades, the Swift Observatory has been studying gamma ray bursts from space. But now, Swift is falling out of orbit. NASA contracted commercial company Catalyst Space to rescue Swift. Using its Link satellite, the plan is to grab onto the observatory and give it a boost back up into orbit. After what appeared to be a successful launch of Link, the satellite now seems to have run into a problem. It's spinning. Catalyst Space engineers are working on fixing the problem. Here to bring us the latest about the rescue mission of the rescue mission is Ars Technica's space reporter Stephen Clark. He's been covering the launch and the technical issues that have arisen on the mission. Stephen, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks, Brendan. Pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you on here, Stephen. Been following along your reporting with this Catalyst mission, Link, that is out there to save the Swift Observatory. But it looks like Link needs saving itself, right? What's the latest? What happened to this spacecraft?
Yeah, so the spacecraft launched back on July the 3rd. As it did its commissioning, did its testing, did its activations in space, which is a weeks-long process, the spacecraft lost attitude control, which means it started tumbling. It started spinning unexpectedly. The investigation now at Catalyst is underway to understand the cause of that. The latest I heard is the investigation is still underway to see what actually precipitated the spin. The spacecraft restored control of the spacecraft using a backup mode that they're still kind of developing on the fly, so to speak, right now. As they use different means to restore attitude control because they lost two of the three reaction wheels. These are momentum wheels that spin very rapidly inside the spacecraft to control the pointing of the spacecraft using discharging momentum instead of using propellant or thrusters. And two of those three wheels have now become inoperable. The investigation suggests that the wheels themselves are not to blame. It's something in the power supply to the wheels that may be the cause of the issue. Right now, the focus really is kind of on along two paths, finding out what happened originally, and then more importantly right now is restoring control of the spacecraft.
All doing this remotely from the ground while time is ticking, because there is a finite amount of time before this spacecraft can link up with the Swift Observatory, right?
Exactly. So Swift is a gamma ray telescope in low Earth orbit. It's been in space since 2004. And right now, the spacecraft is expected to become too low in orbit. The altitude is expected to drop too low for Link to be actually able to rendezvous with it sometime around October. And then late in the year or early next year, it's actually going to be reentering the atmosphere and burning up, which is the whole reason NASA made this deal with Catalyst to go ahead and go up and try to reboost Swift and save it from reentry, because Swift was launched without its own propulsion system. And it's far outlived its original design life. So when they launched Swift back in 2004, they did not expect it to be still operating in 2026. They expected to have it reenter the atmosphere as a dead satellite long after its mission was complete, but it's performed so well over the last almost 22 years that they want to save it.
Let's go back to the issue with the Catalyst spacecraft. When did the ground team know about this? How were they made aware that it was uncontrollable? And what have you heard from the engineers that were working on this? I've got to imagine your heart sinks when you see that data come in, right?
And on July the 25th, on Saturday, July the 25th, is when this incident actually happened. The Link satellite, the rescue mission, is in low Earth orbit, so it passes in and outside of range of different ground stations that are distributed around the world. They lost contact as expected with the Link spacecraft as it moved out of range of one ground station. And when it came back in range of the next ground station as it made its way around the Earth, they noticed it was in this tumble, in this spin, a three-axis spin. So complete attitude control loss. The first thing they've tried to do is to try to restore communication with the spacecraft, because as it's spinning, its antenna is not pointing toward the ground station on Earth that it's supposed to be communicating with. So they have very sporadic communication. Diagnosing the problem to begin with was a big challenge. And then figuring out how to restore the spacecraft and recover it has also been a big challenge. It reminds me of Apollo 13. Gene Kranz, played by Ed Harris, mentions at one point, asks, what do we have on the spacecraft that's good after the explosion of Apollo 13 on the way to the moon, of the service module, rather, as they tried to save that mission? And it kind of reminds me of the process that the Catalyst has been going through. What on the spacecraft is good? Well, they have electric propulsion, which are these very low thrust engines on the spacecraft that are actually supposed to be used to raise the orbit of the spacecraft of Swift when it gets to Swift. There is a low impulse that comes out of those engines, and they can actually gimbal or pivot or vector those engines to use them in another mode they were really never designed to, which is control the attitude or orientation of the spacecraft. And that's what they've been focusing on. They have these three electric engines that are still good and still healthy, and they've been using those to gradually recover attitude control. But again, those are very, very low thrust engines. Like, the impulse that they provide is almost like a couple of sheets of paper on your hand. So it takes time to maneuver this, you know, dishwasher size satellite using those very, very low impulse engines instead of using the reaction wheels. It's going to be a weeks long process to fully arrest the spin. But yeah, the Catalyst control team is based out in Colorado near Denver. They're working around the clock as the spacecraft comes in and out of these ground station communication passes. The communication, again, like I said, has been very intermittent and sporadic because of the spin. But as they slow the spin, which they have been successful in doing, as of a couple of days ago when I last spoke with them, the spin rate had been cut in half, which is a pretty remarkable using these electric plasma thrusters. I spoke with their principal investigator, the lead engineer on the Link rescue mission before the launch. And he was like, you know, this is a risky, high risk mission. And as long as we have communication with the spacecraft and power to the spacecraft, we have options.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Stephen Clark, space reporter with Ars Technica, about the mission to save Swift and the mission to save the mission to save Swift. Stephen, you mentioned my favorite movie there, Apollo 13, you know, finding out what do they have that works on this thing? And it sounds like they're coming up with this plan. This is a scrappy mission from the start, right? I mean, on paper, when you describe this thing, it's a spacecraft that's going to bear hug one that's already in space and then boost it into orbit. Like, really cool, really scrappy mission. But I mean, these engineers, as you mentioned, they were ready for some problems here. You know, are they optimistic that they're going to be able to fix this? And how are they doing that? How are they uploading those instructions to Swift?
They are optimistic. I spoke with their CEO of Catalyst, and he was still very optimistic they're going to be able to recover the spacecraft, get it back under their control. There are lots of things involved in that rendezvous and approach sequence with Swift that they haven't even attempted before. So there's going to be additional risk when that happens. Maybe we can get to that in a minute. But the process of actually uploading the commands to try to recover control of the spacecraft is basically on the ground. They have a team of engineers. They're working closely with NASA, of guidance, navigation, and control engineers on Catalyst's and NASA's side, are working as a team developing new algorithms to upload to the flight computer on board the Link satellite, because the computer on board the spacecraft, it's designed to use different sensors on the spacecraft that sense the sun, sense stars, to kind of locate itself in space to understand where it's pointing. Okay, this star is here, the sun is here, therefore I am pointing in X direction, so to speak. And using these reaction wheels, slowing and speeding them up, tilting them to conserve and discharge momentum to control where it's pointing. Well, with two of those reaction wheels out of commission, they only have one left, which controls its pointing in one axis. They're going to have to use a combination of the remaining healthy reaction wheel and the electric thrusters on board the spacecraft, which I mentioned are these very low thrust engines. And they also have some cold gas thrusters. These are very rudimentary rocket jets that use a high pressure gas, I think nitrogen, but I'm not for sure that they use nitrogen. Most of these applications use cold gas nitrogen. Those are actually used when they actually get close to Swift to do some fine pointing and very, very fine control of the spacecraft, because they have to slide right in underneath Swift. So they have to have exquisite control of spacecraft during that process. Well, those thrusters, some of those thrusters are still healthy as well. And so they're going to use a combination of the electric engines, the cold gas thrusters, and the run reaction wheel through this control mode that they really could never have conceived of before they launched. They're writing this algorithm on the fly, and they're going to uplink that once they fully restore stable pointing to the spacecraft, which they expect to happen within a few days, hopefully, if all goes well.
Let's talk about if all goes well and they are able to rendezvous with Swift. You mentioned earlier that there is also risk involved in what's that particular mission that was planned, right? That portion of the mission. What risk is that? And is there additional risk now? They're using these electronic thrusters that were supposed to help boost the spacecraft. Is there now added risk in there because they've had to utilize these for the rescue portion?
I think certainly this whole situation adds risk to an already risky mission. So they're burning propellant that they would have used for that rendezvous and capture of Swift. They're burning propellant that they would have used if they successfully capture Swift to actually boost its orbit. So they're burning fuel unexpectedly right now. But as for the underlying risk of approaching Swift, so Swift, from NASA's perspective, if they take no action, Swift is going to re-enter the atmosphere. The mission will be over. This is not like the Hubble Space Telescope or the James Webb Space Telescope that's in a stable orbit that has many years of useful life ahead of it. Swift, its death sentence is already signed. It's going to be re-entering the atmosphere in a few months' time. So it's a $500 million mission. They've already gotten significantly more science from it than they wanted to. Sending up this mission to get close to it, to grab onto it with these three robotic arms, certainly if they grab the wrong part of the spacecraft or they lose control of the Link satellite as it's in the vicinity in very close proximity to Swift, you can imagine a scenario where the Link satellite actually bumps Swift and causes damage, causes it to spin out of control itself. But it's in such a low orbit right now that it's, like I said, its end is already nigh. It's already going to be coming to an end very soon. There's very little risk of losing anything by doing this mission, but there's tremendous upside if this mission is actually able to grab on to Swift with these robotic arms and then pulse its engines and actually raise its orbit.
Finally, Stephen, who is watching this mission? Does the success of this mission show that there is the market for these kind of satellite rescue missions, that one, it can be done by a commercial company, and two, NASA's willing to pay for it?
I've been calling this the summer of satellite servicing. This whole market of satellite servicing, refueling, life extension, upgrade in space has been thought about for decades. We obviously saw back in the space shuttle era, astronauts would go up and actually put hands on the Hubble Space Telescope, swap out instruments, change hardware, extend its life to do science that really the astronomers who originally designed Hubble had no idea that it would be able to do decades later. NASA contracted with Link for $30 million, which, of course, sounds like a lot of money, but in the world of space operations and satellites, that's really not very much at all to save a $500 million satellite. This Link mission is partially a mission to save Swift. It's also partially a technology demonstration and just a demonstration that this can be done both technically and also can we go to a startup and say, hey, we want to save our satellite. Can you do this for us at very low cost, relatively speaking? And getting the spacecraft launched, getting it to orbit has already been a pretty big success from NASA's perspective or from Catalyst's perspective. But we'll see if they can close the last few miles here and get to Swift and grab onto it. I like what you said, give it a bear hug. Say hello from planet Earth after 22 years. We're here to save you. So that'll be really cool to see.
Yeah, I love the summer of satellite servicing. It's a great way to describe what's going on. Stephen Clark is reporting on all of that for Ars Technica. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Brendan.
Still to come, when things go wrong in space, how do you fix them?
You want to look at it from the point of view of collecting data. That's why they're always collecting and sending radio signals back to the ground to make sure they have as much information as possible to, in fact, learn if there is an issue and the mission is lost.
How engineers troubleshoot space missions and how they learn from failure. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Troubleshooting a space mission isn't easy. Teams here on the ground have to figure out what's going on based on data alone. They can't peek under the hood of a deployed spacecraft to look for the problem. So just how might the LINC team fix this current problem? And how do engineers plan for trouble once a spacecraft leaves the planet? Don Platt is the director of Florida Tech's Space Force Education Center in Titusville. He joins us now to walk us through that process. Don, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Don, we're talking about the Catalyst Space LINC mission. You know, teams are troubleshooting it. But let's talk first. How do you know that there's a problem with your spacecraft in the first place? It's in space. You're on the ground. How do you know?
Unfortunately, for most spacecraft, the only way that we can ever interact with the spacecraft is by the radio link. And so we've got to get data back from the spacecraft to first off tell us what's wrong or something is wrong. And then we can look at that data and look at the details of that data to try to figure out exactly what went wrong. And that's sort of the first step in the process to moving forward to eventually then trying to create a troubleshooting plan to come up with a solution to the issue that's at hand. It's not an easy process, for sure. It's not even, you know, imagine, say your car. Imagine if you had something wrong with your car and the only thing you had to tell you what was going on is a communications link to your car. You say, okay, is the engine working? Or, you know, do the tires have air? Does it have gas? So you got to look at all of the kind of the typical things that could go wrong and kind of go down a list of troubleshooting steps. So they'll create essentially a flow chart of steps before the mission even happens, identifying what are the most likely causes of a problem and how would they sort of manifest themselves. So you've got to go through all of that, identify the problem first before you can even have a chance to figure out how to fix it.
What are those first steps when you get that radio signal from a spacecraft that says, help, I'm in trouble?
Traditionally speaking, spacecraft have had what they call safe mode. And so they have a level of smarts on board that can say, hey, something seems off here. I'm maybe not even positive what it is, but I'm going to make sure I don't damage myself even more. And so it'll go into a very simple mode. It won't try anything daring or dangerous. It won't try to fire rocket engines typically or maneuver in any way. So it'll kind of hunker down and call home and say, help, I've got something wrong here, and I'm not positive what it is, but we need to look at it.
So what do you do? What has that spacecraft sent down that you can use to troubleshoot what is actually happening?
Yeah, well, there's a series of what is called engineering telemetry or engineering data that is sent down from every spacecraft. And so that tells you the status of every subsystem, pressures and tanks, the position of any kind of a device that could move, like an antenna, say, for instance, the solar panels, are they pointed properly to the sun where they're supposed to be? Are there enough voltage in the batteries? Essentially, are they charged? Kind of like if you look at your phone and say, oh, I've only got 5% left. So they look at all of those components, all part of a telemetry stream that gets sent to the ground. So that's why they try to maintain a link as often as possible to get this data down, because you don't want to store it on board and then have something go wrong and you can't get at it later.
You're sifting through all that data trying to figure out what went wrong. And I think you used the term fault tree. Is that what you said? Tell us a bit about what that is.
So the engineers will sit down before the mission even flies and say, what are the most likely things to go wrong and how would they present themselves? So it's kind of like a doctor can maybe go through and look at your lab test and look at how you're telling him how you feel and maybe examine yourself. And of course, with our spacecraft, except for nowadays, of course, with cameras, for the most part, previously, we were never able to actually look at the spacecraft. So we'd go through all of those steps and say, is this working? Is that working? If this isn't working, what is the major reason or most probable reason that that would not be working on board the spacecraft? And then you'd go down to the next step and say, okay, from that step, then what would we want to look at next to try to figure out, say, for instance, if you're not getting the batteries to charge properly, you could say, okay, well, maybe it's the solar panels aren't pointed properly due to the sun. And so you'd look at what is the orientation of the spacecraft with respect to the sun? And do we then expect that the solar panels should be getting enough power to charge the batteries? And then is there a problem with the batteries? Is something turned on that's not supposed to be on? You know, and it has, killed the battery. We left the car lights on. And so now the battery doesn't have the proper charge in it. And so you go through each step and you say, is this working or is it not working? Yeah. So like I say, they put that all together before the mission even happens. And so then they can walk through that fault tree analysis and, you know, and come to a final conclusion about what went wrong.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Don Platt, director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville, about what happens when a mission in space goes wrong. Don, it sounds to me that the expectation is with a spacecraft and with a space mission, something is going to go wrong, right? It's just a matter of what and how badly. Is that how engineers think about these space missions, which are incredibly complex?
Yeah, you have to, because you don't want to get into the situation where when you're flying the mission, suddenly something goes wrong and you're saying, oh my, something went wrong. We didn't think that would happen. So you have to think, even things that maybe you think, well, that doesn't seem like it's very likely that that's going to happen. So you have to kind of identify all of that ahead of time, because when something does go wrong in space, oftentimes you don't have a lot of time to recover. If you get the batteries all the way discharged to zero, you may not be able to maneuver the spacecraft or even communicate with it any longer. And so that'll be a dead spacecraft. And so you have to be very proactive. Looking at problems, trying to sort of anticipate what the next step would be or what the next aspect of the problem could be, say tomorrow, compared to maybe today it's pretty good, but tomorrow it could go down into the red zone.
You know, once you do figure out what went wrong, how do you fix it? It's in space.
The key is designing into the spacecraft resiliency. And so that part of that is oftentimes redundancy. So you have backup systems. If one battery doesn't work, then there's another one that has been fully charged and ready to go. So then you can switch the power system over to that backup battery and recover the problem. And that gives you more time then to try to figure out why the primary battery went dead. But the key element is really this idea of redundancy. Some of the modern spacecraft, even things like the Starlink satellites, where you have thousands and thousands of satellites, they may just write it off at one point. Obviously, they want to make sure that satellite doesn't become derelict in orbit and become space debris to other spacecraft. So oftentimes, they'll just force it to reenter before it gets into a dead satellite situation. But for bigger and more expensive and complex satellites, then you'll have redundant systems with a backup. And sometimes that backup is not quite as good as the main system, but it can get you by enough to then troubleshoot, maybe switch over the power system. Sometimes you're stuck having to rely on that backup system. Like for instance, an antenna. Oftentimes an antenna may go bad and maybe it won't even deploy. Some of these antennas look like umbrellas. And so they pop out when they get into their final position in space. Once in a while, those antennas fail to pop out. What they call then dish antennas are essentially like an upside down umbrella, have a very high gain or a high amount of power available to allow them to communicate at high data rates. You may have an antenna that is much smaller, but it'll still allow you to send some data back and forth. And so then you could switch over to that backup, continue troubleshooting, and in some instances, even complete the mission with that smaller backup antenna.
Redundancy is key. Always travel with two umbrellas, right? Especially in Florida.
Right, exactly. Especially in Florida.
Don, we heard earlier in the program from Stephen Clark, who's been following this for Ars Technica. We did reach out to Catalyst Space. They were unable to give us anybody for an interview for this. But through Stephen's reporting, we found out that they're pretty optimistic that they'll be able to come to a fix and right this satellite. But if they don't, Don, are there ever really failures in space missions, or will the engineers learn from whatever this issue is?
Yeah, you usually always learn, and that's why you always got to collect data. You know, even we saw with the Blue Origin explosion on the pad, they collected a lot of data. They understand better their rocket system, and now they're rebuilding what will hopefully then be a better pad for future missions. And so you want to look at it from the point of view of collecting data. That's why they're always collecting and sending radio signals back to the ground to make sure they have as much information as possible to, in fact, learn if there is an issue and the mission is lost. And we definitely don't want that same thing to happen again in the future. So how do we redesign the system? How do we make it more fail-safe? How do we add a level of redundancy to the next spacecraft that comes down the line?
Going into this mission, we knew that this was a high-risk mission with a very high reward should it work. It saves a $500 million spacecraft for the cost of $30 million. All eyes have got to be watching this mission. If it does succeed in saving Swift? How does that change the space industry, knowing that commercial companies can go up there and fix satellites while they're in orbit?
Right. Well, we talked about earlier here that for the most part throughout the space age, the only thing we had was a data link to the satellite. And so we had to look at data and we had to kind of come to conclusions about maybe things that are wrong with the spacecraft and then try to figure out how by just sending some commands and maybe switching between different systems, we can protect and save the satellite and make sure the mission is a success. We said that we can't really see it, like when we're working on a car, we can look at what's wrong with it. Well, this changes the game because now we're able to see the spacecraft, we're able to interact with it, and we're able to then make adjustments and make fixes. And so a spacecraft like this one would be sort of an extension of the humans to allow them to actually have, if you will, hands-on with the spacecraft. And this will allow us not only to troubleshoot problems and fix problems, but to refuel satellites in the future so that running out of propellant is not the end of the mission, maybe change batteries, make other adjustments. And so instead of having to launch a brand new spacecraft again, you can kind of fix a few problems here and there and let it run for another 5 or 10 years.
Get your eyes under the hood there and see what's going on, right?
Right. Absolutely.
So finally, Don, I know you've worked on hardware that's been to space. What advice do you have or words of wisdom would you give to these engineers who are problem solving this issue in the here and now?
Well, typically what you want to do is you look at all the alternatives. What are all of the things that possibly could go wrong? And don't just sort of have a predisposition about what went wrong, what happened, what the issue was. Have an open mind to the problem and make sure you look at all of the data. And then come to some conclusions. It's always good if you have a component here on the ground and you can test and verify ahead of time and see if you can recreate the problem. And then if you can recreate the problem, that's wonderful because then you can fix it. And then you can say, okay, if we just do this with what we have available, if, you know, the famous Apollo 13 movie scene where they have a cardboard box with stuff. Okay, we got to make sure these astronauts can stay alive with just what we have in this cardboard box. So that kind of thing.
So look for alternatives and maybe check the headlights, see if that was the problem, right?
Exactly.
Don Platt, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Don Platt, director of Florida Tech's Spaceport Education Center in Titusville. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. If you've got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.